then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely croon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's April the 26th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I want to begin this week by nattering a bit with you on the subject of conspiracy theory. Now, I'm going to be ad-libbing this without a script, so I may ramble a bit. Now, last week, when I talked about the Oklahoma City bombing, I set off one of our usual movement teapot tempests in the comments section on our Homeland blog on the subject of conspiracy theory. Should we or shouldn't we? Not so much about Oklahoma City, which is what I was talking about on the anniversary last week, but as regards the events of 9/11. Oddly enough, this has become a rather tender subject in the movement, such as the movement is these days, which is mostly on the internet. Hell, outside of our few small groups and get-togethers here in the Northwest, it's all internet. Now, have you noticed that none of these neocon or pseudo-intellectual racist groups with their little blogs even seem to have actual meetings anymore these days? Not even in rented motel banquet rooms, not anywhere. I think Jared Taylor tries to have an American Renaissance conference once a year, if he can find a motel that'll have him, where the management doesn't crumple when the telephoned bomb threats start. We're not the only ones with no property to meet on. Most of our people have become so poor that they can't even have real meetings in their homes because none of them have the McMansions anymore. Most racially aware white people now live in fleabag furnished apartments or trailers or their parents' basement. Now, if anything, this has gotten worse over the past 3 or 4 years. It's all being done online through video conferencing and so forth, so none of us have to get our lazy asses in a car and do any long-distance driving. And, of course, anything we do on the line, the regime can monitor. Sorry, I'm babbling here. Okay, there are a few people among us who believe or pretend to believe the official version of 9/11 about it just being some pissed-off Muslims with box cutters. And these guys are quite passionate in advocating that the white nationalist movement should not indulge in conspiracy theory at all. In fact, Don Black is so hepped on this idea that he's actually banned any discussion of the 9/11 truth movement on Stormfront, along with any manifestations of National Socialism, along with the word nigger, so forth and so on. He's expelled a number of people from Stormfront over this, hundreds of them in fact, or else his infamous moderators, over whom he exercises almost no control or authority, have done this. Now, Don Black himself seems to have become an almost absentee landlord on the site. Apparently he's trying to go respectable because his son Derek wants to pursue a career in the Republican Party in South Florida. Now, I'm not sure why a guy like Don Black, with his lifetime of experience, would believe that it would ever be possible that any of us would ever be allowed to rejoin the mainstream if we tap dance and shuffle in front of the Jews regarding 9/11, but that's what it looks like that would ever happen. Hell, David Duke has been trying to get back into the mainstream for years, and he's never gotten anywhere near it. Neither will any of us. Now, the point I'm trying to make here is that it's absolutely useless for us to go crawling to the power structure and lick their feet and promise to be good and not talk about certain things they don't want people talking about. The power structure never responds by rewarding us. None of us who have ever uttered the forbidden J word and been overheard, even so much as once in our lives, will ever be allowed back into the charmed circle of mainstream social approval. We always need to remember that. I suppose I should think up a little aphorism similar to A.K. Chesterton's. He said, if they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. Once you say Jew, then you're through. So why not? Why shouldn't we discuss conspiracy theory in general and 9/11 in particular? Now, these people, who tend to get downright apoplectic on the subject, claim that, quote-unquote, it makes us look like kooks. Now, this, of course, is based on the premise, which many of us hold to, very sincerely, that somehow or other, someday, we will produce a mass movement of the old European style, with millions of dues-paying members and the long brown columns marching down the street yelling Heil Larry or whatever. In other words, these people believe that somehow or other, we will be allowed to access or be able to force our way into the mainstream media sufficiently to speak to the millions of white inhabitants of this continent. I won't say anything about that right now, except that I really hope these people are right, and I really hope that does happen. As I've mentioned before, it has to happen here in the Northwest. People have to learn that we're here. I would give my eye teeth to be able to sit down behind a microphone and talk for an hour or so every day with just Rush Limbaugh's audience, never mind Fox News. We need for this to happen, but we also need to deal with the possibility that it won't. Okay, now getting back to not talking about 9/11 so people don't think we're kooky, I can see what these folks are saying here, and I'm well aware of the necessity of our not appearing kooky to people and not immediately confronting them with symbols and ideas that they've been conditioned from birth to reject. I've talked about this myself in the past. This is why I don't wear the costume anymore or use the swastika overtly. There was a time when I would have regarded that as the most cowardly form of compromise, but I'm quite capable of understanding the need for compromise and for meeting people at least halfway on their own terms and putting ourselves on a credible basis of communication with them. But why never discuss these things at all? Why do we allow the Jews and their system and their power structure and their media to set the parameters of acceptable discussion? That is one of the main sources of Jewish power, the power or the ability to set the parameters of what may be discussed by others. Bismarck once wrote that the mark of a true liberal is an inability to believe in conspiracies, and Bismarck knew about such things. I'm not convinced that in order to blend in, we need to refrain from discussing or advocating anything that contradicts the establishment's mainstream or official version of events. Now, for one thing, it won't do us any good, because like I said, the power structure doesn't recognize any quid pro quo, so it's no good sucking up to them. Now, for another thing, the masses of white Americans, if they're the ones we're going after, aren't quite as stupid as we think they are. Not quite. And there is, in fact, a lot of genuine skepticism about 9/11 among a lot of ordinary people, based on some pretty obvious flaws and questionable points in the official version of events. Now, true, there are some people on our side, really obsessive people on the other side of this issue, involved with the 9/11 truth movement, and frankly, they can be as much of a bore as the stuffed shirt fuddy-duddies who dismiss anyone questioning the official version as cranks. I know people in the movement who have gone off the deep end and become nothing but raving 9/11 truthers. They've become real cranks on the subject. It's all they talk about or post about. White nationalism and white separatism should not turn into a 9/11 truth movement per se. 9/11 was an incident in the collapse of this country and in the seizure by the government of tyrannical power. It happened, and we need to talk about it, but it's not a primary concern. It can dissipate our energies and drain what little we have in the way of time and resources. But I think there's no harm in incorporating a little conspiracy theory. It's like Holocaust revisionism. And by the way, there are people who claim we shouldn't mention Holocaust revisionism either because the masses of people are too stupid and brainwashed to understand it. But just because speaking the truth to people is hard and frustrating, and largely pointless, granted, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. We should never, ever give up trying to make our own people understand the truth. It's part of who we are and what we do. I think that while alternative versions of history need to be part of our program and our propaganda, we mostly need to concentrate on a few basics that can be reduced to a few simple slogans. And above all, we need to concentrate on the idea of a sovereign homeland for white people here in the Pacific Northwest. Always remember, that's the cure for what ails us. Our own state and our own government and our own land. Now, we need to get a lot better than we have been at avoiding all these distractions that prevent us from, at long last, getting down to business and getting this job done. We're great at thinking up abstruse excuses and reasons for not getting on with it. Conspiracy theory overall is, generally speaking, such a distraction. Americans have always been very big on single-issue politics, abortion, or gun rights, or anti-gay marriage, or fluoride in the water, whatever. Now we need to put blinkers on so we don't get distracted and keep our vision firmly ahead, eyes on the prize. Okay, unfortunately, according to the Federal Communications Commission, we still have not fulfilled our quarterly quota of minority viewpoint and racial diversity on this program. I went over to Dry Ice's place in Rainier Valley to see if he was available to do something for us this week, and unfortunately, Dry Ice was in jail. Seems he broke into some convenience store over there run by Koreans. It was in the middle of the night, and he loaded up a shopping cart with all kinds of bottles of Carlo Rossi and boxes of Banquet fried chicken and ho-hos and all this sort of stuff. And he started pushing it down a median strip, going back to his apartment in the projects. But he kind of got into the stuff, and he was eating and drinking it. And the cops basically followed this trail of empty wine bottles and chicken bones until they found him lying against a tree with this shopping cart full of stolen stuff. And anyway, they arrested Dry Ice, and he's now suing the Seattle Police Department for racial profiling. Probably win. Anyway, the fact is, Dry Ice is not available this week, so once again, we got Effie Sue. So here, in fulfillment of the federal requirement for community participation and diversity, blah, 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 well, here she goes.
Hello, chillin'. It's me, Effie Sue Washington here. And no, I don't want to be, but I gots to be. I gots to be because once again the dumbasses and attention-greedy motherfuckers of the country have decided to take a situation that they ain't got a goddamn thing to do with and completely blow it out of fucking control. Trayvon Martin. Boy, won't you be glad when you don't have to turn on the news and see them words or hear that name again. Trayvon Martin. Is it tragic? Of course it's tragic. Is it surprising? Fuck no, it ain't. And if the stupid shit Negroes of the world would stop flapping their spoon lips long enough for somebody to say, wait a minute, wait just a fucking minute here, there may be more to this than we being told, everything would be a lot better. But oh no, like always, attention-seeking, camera-greedy, self-centered, fucking all-about-me-me-me types has decided to turn this into a goddamn whirlpool of shit, and they have done one hell of a job. And, as always, everybody's pointing the finger of blame somewhere other than where it should be. Let's start with you, Daddy. Oh, yeah, that's right, you. You worthless fucking sperm donor. Where the fuck were you when the boy was shot? Out to dinner with your fucking girlfriend, or whore of the day, whatever. Took the woman out to dinner and left a 17-year-old at home just expecting him to do right. Nigga, have you lost your goddamn nappy-headed mind? Tell me something. What do you think a 17-year-old boy with a dick that stay hard 10 out of the 12 hours he ain't fucking sleeping a day is thinking about? The same thing you had on your fucking mind. Fucking being the word of choice here. If you hadn't had that on your mind, you might have invited him to the restaurant to eat with you. And what the fuck do you think he was doing in a neighborhood with a security guard in the first place? Do you know why neighborhoods with security guards have security guards? To keep the low-rent, thieving, dope-selling, worthless niggas out. Why was he there? Because it's a place he wasn't supposed to go. And all 17-year-olds wants to go to a place where they ain't supposed to go. Truth be knowing, he was probably up in there trolling some high-dollar white girl pussy like 90% of young black bucks be doing today. And who could blame him? Every time they turn on the fucking TV or pick up a goddamn magazine, they see some low-cut white trash whore hugged up on a multi-million-dollar music nigga or an athlete with muscles bulging in both his shirt and his pants. He knew he wasn't supposed to be there. That's exactly what the fuck the nigga was doing there. Him and his gonna show somebody attitude. And proof of that is the fact he was on the phone with his girlfriend. And while we on that subject, what about you, baby? Telling him, run, Trayvon. That signifies that you be partially numb from your neck up. Let's see. A nigga in a protected high-class neighborhood, wearing a hoodie, running through the streets. Oh, I can't fucking imagine why anybody would be suspicious of that. I mean, anybody. First of all, would have to wonder, what the fuck is somebody doing wearing a hoodie in Florida in the first place? The fucking temperature never get below 60 fucking degrees. I mean, do the nigga think that people want to smell the funk coming from him like steam rising off a fresh turd just cause he want to look fashionable? Nigga, please. And mama? Oh yeah, mama down in Miami. Don't think I'm gonna let you off easy either. We done heard about the empty baggie of marijuana that got the boy kicked out of school. Is this all part of your raising the boy right attitude like you say you got? Now, if your lazy bitch ass had raised him right, you would have never let him run off and join gangs like we found out on his Facebook page. Instead, you would have jerked him up by the pants he wore around his knees until his genitalia pop out that baboon-sized nose of his. Then, he would have had more sense than to go sneaking into predominantly white neighborhoods protected by Mexicans. And speaking of which, what the fuck is a white Mexican? Is that one who eats less beans and more cheeseburgers? Look, a Mexican is a Mexican, a greaser is a greaser, a spick is a spick, a black person is a black person, and a nigger is a nigger. We all know who each other is, and ain't none of us likes the other's worth of shit, so let's just get that straight right now. We get a chance to fight, we gon' fight. We get a chance to fuck each other over, we gon' fuck each other over. They get the chance to fuck us, they gon' do that too. Call it turf wars, call it whatever the fuck you want to. Hey, remember, the majority of us, they just got out the fucking jungle and brought over on the boats a couple hundred years ago. You don't expect us to be civilized yet, do you? Now, as for the rest of you camera-happy, media-loving, useless motherfuckers, maybe y'all just ought to stay the fuck out of this. Starting with you, Jesse fucking Jackson. Oh, yeah. Every time there be an opportunity, magically, your black ass show up from out of nowhere with an opinion nobody fucking cares about or asked you for. And Al Sharpton, that goes for your fat fried chicken eating ass, too. Did either one of you niggas even know where the fuck Stanford, Florida was? Or if it even existed before this? Hell the fuck no. But oh, goddamn, you all fucking about it now, ain't you? Mm-hmm. Ready to load up the buses with unemployed Negroes that ought to have their asses out job hunting to keep more young black youths from ending up wearing bullet holes because they're too fucking worthless to get a job and support the offspring while they wait for them to get old enough to draw welfare, social security, and vote in another worthless piece of sperm-tan shit like Barack Hussein fucking Obama. And speaking of which, you, Mr. I'm so upset about this fucking do nothing but blame everybody else leader what used to be the greatest nation on earth, saying you ain't never seen nothing so sad. How about going to the border, nigga? Mexicans be cutting off each other's heads every day over the same kind of dope this nigga got caught at school with. Oh, no. You run your fucking Oreo ass down to Florida and say justice need to be done. You know, if you really believe that shit that drew from your half nigger lips, you'd be producing a real birth certificate and maybe some college transcripts. What you need to be doing is finding a way to get this fucking country out of the goddamn mess you got us into and quit blaming every fucking body you can point your crooked fucking basketball dribbling finger at, nigga. Gas is $4 a gallon. That bother anybody besides FSU? Guess not, especially when you riding fucking buses that ain't paying for it. Look, the shooting of Trayvon is a tragedy. The shooting of anybody, anytime, anywhere is a tragedy, but it happens every day. The real tragedy in this case is that nobody really knows what the fuck really happened, but everybody got something to say about it like they think they fucking do. You niggas wasn't there, you don't know, and now thanks to your goddamn flapping blue gum lips, ain't nobody ever gonna know. Once again, you done gone and fucked up everything. But it ain't the first time, and we all know it ain't gonna be the last. I will say this, though. At least, that's twice now that niggas has been eager to hop on a bus to go somewhere. First Gina, Louisiana, now Stanford, Florida. So, I reckon Hurricane Katrina must have taught you brain-dead, sperm-donating niggas something. Damn shame, because I for one believe the good Lord needs to take out a few more of you dumbass coons with another big storm. Oh, yeah, one more fucking thing. Spike fucking Lee, if you decide to make a movie out of this, you can get Halle Berry to play my part. But if you get Sidney Poitier to play Barack Obama, I will play the part of Michelle, even though my ass ain't nowhere near big as her. And that is what needs to be said. I am Effie Sue Washington. Thank you very fucking much. I'm out.
Okay, first music break. This week we're going to feature a single group. It's, well, I'm not quite sure what you'd call them, about half folk, half rock group. They're called Rollins Cross. Their music is kind of hard to describe. It's kind of a modernized rock with a lot of traditional Scottish elements, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, give it a listen and see what you think.
Goes open. Hello, comrades. I would like to start off by saying that I, Axis Sally, have been kicked out of the video arcade. I took my kids there yesterday, since it's their spring break, and we were just playing games, and then the manager told us that we couldn't be there during school hours since the kids were under 18. I did see the signs everywhere that explained as much, but I figured during spring break it would be okay. I explained that it was their break, and he said that break was last week. I figured it wasn't worth it to fight about video games, so we left instead. But this is, of course, about so much more than video games. The kids were on break. I'm their mom, and I know when spring break is. The store manager knew nothing about my school district or my family. What if we were homeschooling? What if we were in private school? What if the kids had been expelled for drawing swastikas or bringing toy guns? Or what if school was fully in session and I just decided that, as their parent, I felt like pulling them out of class for the day to goof off at the mall? This is my family. I decide where they will be and how they will spend their day. Many parents don't know they have that option. And in this case, I'm not talking about your God-given rights as a white mother to make decisions about your children's activities. I'm talking about the actual legal government-sanctioned right to decide where, how, and under what conditions your children will be educated. I won't pretend to know the different rules for different states, but in places that allow homeschooling, many also allow a child to attend public school for part of the day and be homeschooled the rest of the day, or to be fully homeschooled and then take part in the school's sports or other after-school activities. If this interests you, don't check with your school district, seek out other homeschooling parents, and find out exactly what you can do that won't have the child welfare office knocking on your door. I know as well as anyone else that the parent, not the institution, is the best monitor of the child's learning. I, not a standardized test, should be the one to decide whether or not my children are educated enough, and I should also be the one to decide whether or not they deserve to take a day off in the middle of the week. It's also up to me when they are allowed to be in a store that caters mainly to children. Trust me, I'm not some assbag who demands the right to bring rambunctious kids into a restaurant or other adult establishment. But if I decide that at 1 p.m. on a school day that we're not going to school, we're going to the pet store, that's my call to make as the mother. Do you know why your kid is so fat? It's partly due to your feeding him junk because you're too lazy to cook, but remember, generations ago, children ate cupcakes and burgers and drank soda, but weren't fat and soft like they are today. But back then, kids were allowed to be active. They were allowed to get dirty and roughhouse and tear their clothes and skin their knees. Kids didn't have hours of homework back then, homework that is largely useless busy work and not real education. You don't need to do worksheets for hours after school when you're 8 years old in order to be smart and have a real future. Have you, listeners, ever sought the services of a doctor or other professional who is really super smart and had to go to school for a long, long time? If so, you paid someone and trusted the advice of someone who went to school back in the days when their homework was a few papers they could stuff in their pockets, not piles of books that today's kids have to drag around in those wheeled backpacks because they're too weak to lift. Of course, with all that homework, kids don't have time for climbing trees and playing in the mud, so they get softer and fatter while they color on worksheets and fill in the blanks. There's no more real gym time in school, no real recess, because kids aren't allowed to really play anymore. And don't tell me all this extra work is making them smarter. How many teenagers do you know who don't know how to do laundry or make lasagna? These kids need to be pulled out of school for a week and made to learn every single thing there is to know about helping around the house and in the kitchen. The math can wait. In my ideal world, it is the parents who raise, socialize, and educate the children. They may seek help and advice from others with these matters, or they may choose to do this on their own. But no one has the right to make these decisions for another family. When did mothers start believing that everyone else knew what was best for their own children? When did we give up the right to take charge of our own? This is my family, this is my future, this is my blood. Video games are stupid anyway. I wanted to go to the aquarium. I have to admit, I was wrong about all you pot smokers and how all you do is sit in your mom's basements with your ferrets and your weird rainbow hangy things. Turns out some pot smokers are actually sort of responsible for killing Jews, which means I love you guys more than anything. See, apparently Israel has a shortage of civilian gas masks. These gas masks are being sold in New York with the protective filters removed and replaced with foot-long acrylic bongs made for smoking marijuana. According to this Jewish news thing, gas mask bongs had been flooding American head shops about a decade ago, which is about the time the Israeli government recalled millions of masks they had distributed to civilians during the invasion of Iraq. These black masks with circular eye holes are authentic Israeli gas masks. When used as smoking devices, they form a seal around the user's face, which locks in the smoke and forces it all into the lungs at once. So, for every one of these you buy and use for this weird practice, that's one Jew who didn't get one. This is so amazing. The article says, though the Israeli government has just finished distributing 4 million of the masks to its citizens, production is now stopped, according to a recent report in the Jerusalem Post, and budget shortfalls will mean that 40% of Israelis won't receive the masks from the government. Only 4 million masks? Guess they won't hit their 6 million number yet again. Because of all you stoners, 40% of the Israeli Jews will now die from poison gas. So I have to revise my original stance on you who smoke drugs. If you don't, then don't start. But for those of you who do, keep at it. Buy yourself one of these masks and inhale the sweet knowledge that a Jew died for your debauchery. I guess even if you're not a druggie, you should still be buying these masks so the kikes can't have them. Buy them and make lampshades out of them or something. Anyway, while you guys are doing that, I have to say I look forward to meeting the Spokane area comrades this weekend at our secret location where we will go over all our big secret important things. And guys, it's okay to have meetings like this without heralds or my say-so. We encourage comrades not to be strangers, to actually physically get out of the house and off the computer and away from your dead Jew bong and meet one another. Meet the person who may be your greatest ally in the fight to save your race. But since we need to maintain a somewhat normal appearance for now, I have to ask those of you who plan to rush out and buy one of those gas masks after listening to this podcast, please don't bring it to the thing.
We always seem to have our best discussions in the living room, and then we can never remember what to talk about when we get in here.
Aliens! It was space aliens!
Well, actually, that was close. Remember, we were talking about the space program.
Yep, we were.
I wasn't here.
Nope, you weren't here.
We'll talk about it again.
Getting lunch.
Okay, right. Yeah, right. Okay. Well, Mac was just pointing out that there's no real reason why we shouldn't have colonies on Mars right now. I'm writing in my latest novel about the time in the future when the Northwest Republic will be the only nation on Earth with colonies on the Moon and Mars, but there's no real reason why America couldn't have men on Mars and men on the Moon right now. I mean, we started this in the 1960s, for God's sake. That's almost 50 years ago. We went to the Moon, and then we just quit.
Yeah, as I was looking at an old novel you had on one of your tables there, and I was reminiscing about some old novels that I used to read, probably still have, concerning colonization of Mars and the outer planets. And it just struck me that Kennedy got the ball rolling and got us on the Moon in just a few years, and then it stopped. And if we had just stopped giving so much money, billions of dollars every year to Israel, if we had just took that money and put it towards our space program, in the time since Kennedy, we could have had people walking on Mars. We could have had moon stations, you know, base stations to launch from the Moon. We could have had quality space stations around our planet, around Mars. We could have had colonies on Mars. We could be exploring it, exploring the outer planets. But no, we got to give the money to Jews and MUDs.
Yep.
Well, there's all those anti-bullying programs, too. They're, you know, don't forget, a lot of our money goes to things like that. But I remember reading in A Distant Thunder, and then at the end of the book, when you find out it's going to something on Mars or whatever, I thought, you know, this is really hokey. And then I realized, no, this is what we could have in as little as 100 years when we get rid of all these niggers and everything else we're throwing money away on. And just this morning, I was looking through a book of useless random lists, you know, here's the top 10 of this, and then one was 10 first people in space, 10 first people on the Moon, or whatever. And Mac is right. We quit after about the 60s or 70s. It was just like, okay, yeah, we're not doing this anymore. It was fun while it lasted.
Well, now even the space shuttle programs, our first nigger president gets up there and shuts down the goddamn space program. We don't even have the shuttles going up there anymore. All they're doing now in the one space station we have up there, the International Space Station, because you just can't have things for white people. You got to have the Chinese and the Japanese and the Mexicans and the Puerto Ricans and, you know, the other cans up there. You know,
African American lesbian judges.
And the only thing they do up there is they study how mold grows in outer space.
There is a space program, but most of it's classified. In other words, most of it has to do with spying on people. If you watch 24, where Jack Bauer's running around trying to kill the evil terrorist, he's always calling Chloe for satellite pictures and satellite tracking of some guy driving down the highway in a green Cortina or something like this. And that technology exists. That basically is what a lot of our space technology has been converted to, is spying and so-called intelligence gathering. And they have satellites right now. If you go out in the parking lot and lay a dime down on the concrete, some satellite can tell you whether it's heads or tails. I mean, what do you think Google Maps is? But still,
more than that, the satellite technology that they have currently up there, they can read the newspaper over your shoulder. They can tell you what date of the dime was if it was heads up.
Yeah. This is what our grand and glorious urge to conquer the stars has been transformed into. I don't want to go completely off on another Grandpa Simpson rave here, but back in the day, the 60s and whatnot, when I was growing up, I was a science fiction kid. I used to read all the classic science fiction authors. With an onion on my belt. But the thing, anyway, but you know, Brian Aldiss, Robert Heinlein, Ray Bradbury, Edmund Hamilton, all these people that would write stories of colonies on Mars and the moon. And
H.G. Wells.
I read the early stuff as well. Jules Verne, H.G. Wells. And I fully expected when I was in junior high school, that's when, especially the year Star Trek first came out. Yeah, I know, but I mean, I was 13 at the time, I think, because who cares, but I didn't know what a Jew was. But anyway, the fact is, I fully expected, and I was just beginning to think about what I wanted to do in life, and one of the things I figured I wanted to do was something so I could eventually immigrate to outer space and live on the moon or on Mars. And I used to mention this casually to people around me, my parents, and the fact is that at that time, say in 65, 66, no one thought there was anything unusual about this, and everyone pretty much thought that it would be possible that by the time I was 58 years old, we would have colonies on Mars, colonies on Venus, colonies on the moon. Of course, now we know we can't really colonize Venus because it's about 800 degrees.
Well, not to mention the acid rain's enough to melt a spaceship in a few hours.
Yeah, there is that. But bear in mind, in those days, we didn't know this. This was kind of an age of innocence. We have learned more about the planets, of course, from the things like Mars rovers and some of those probes that landed on Venus or crashed into Venus, I should say. I don't think anybody's ever been able to successfully land on Venus itself because the surface is probably molten. But the thing is that most of the space effort in the past couple of decades has been robotic because it's become too politically sensitive to try and send people out into space because I think there's too much chance of failure. That's ever since that was it. Columbia went down over Texas. That was about 2002 or so, 2003. I think they backed off on the shuttle then because these human failures are just too embarrassing and somebody might eventually figure out that it's due to affirmative action and this sort of stuff. So it's really a shame because, again, I'm going on into my golden years now, but I'm serious. When I was young, many young people of my generation dreamed of living our lives on other planets and being part of a colonization effort for outer space, and that's one dream that political correctness and all this bullshit has taken from the kids of my generation. It's one of the things that I think we're all going to remember when the time comes to get even. These people have run up quite a bill, and it's not just in the areas you might think. Anyway, I'm babbling again, so.
Well, we white people have been on the forefront of every major technological advancement, from tall ships to spaceships, and there is no reason why we white people cannot, again, attain that level of being on the forefront of everything. We should have colonies on Mars. We should be, at this point in time, exploring deep, deep space. The Voyager missions were one thing. We need to be able to expand beyond that. And I think if we can get white people together and form a new nation so that we have the ability to cultivate the desire to reach out, then it shouldn't be that long after creating our own country that we can have colonies on Mars and be exploring Io and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, as Sally was talking about the one book where I concluded that it turned out that the reporter was interviewing Shane Ryan came from the Mars colony. I mentioned this also in the opening of Hell of the Ravens when it turns out that Don Redman's son is an astronaut and he's on Mars. And there was a comment in there that I had one of my characters make, and that is that you would be surprised.
Is it Matt Redman?
No, Don. Don Redman was the boss agent in Hell of the Ravens. Matt Redman was the detective in Fire and Rain. What? Don Redman is Matt Redman's nephew.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Actually, if you start with Rose of Honor, you'll follow the Redmond family since the Middle Ages, but we won't get into that. Anyway, okay, now, Before I digress there. Anyway, one of my characters says, and I think it's true, that he was talking about the Northwest American Republic space program. He says, you will be amazed at what can be accomplished when you have a productive white population and you don't have all these parasites living off the state and living off the community. And you've got at least some degree of efficiency and you're not wasting your money on all this bullshit, basically, that America wastes money on. I mean, the sheer amount of we wouldn't have to raise another penny of taxes, even in this country as it is, if we could just somehow streamline this country's finances, stop the insane spending, and spend what we do have sensibly. But we won't do that because basically the government uses tax money to bribe its own constituencies to vote it into power. And, well, you know the whole story there. But just think, what could be done if we did have a sane, stable, efficient, and intelligent white government in this country or in any part of it? We could still be on Mars in our grandchildren's time.
Kill a nigger, put a man on the moon.
Okay. He's gone. Now we can talk about him behind his back.
Can you believe what he's wearing? Jersey Shore t-shirt.
We'll put that on there. We were talking about you behind your back. Yeah. She was commenting on your Jersey Shore t-shirt.
It's not really your best look.
Okay. Oh, baby. Oh, baby.
All right. Okay. Just to refresh you guys' memories, about a month ago, there was a teacher in Minneapolis named Tim Olmsted who was dismissed from his job as a public school teacher because he lost his temper with his nigglet students. Apparently, he was junior high school, something like that. And he just lost his temper with them and told them they were useless and they were fat and they were ugly and they'd never be any good. And in other words, he did something that is unforgivable for a white person, especially a white male in this society. He told the truth. I'm sure his nigger students were fat and lazy and ugly and they'll never amount to anything. Anyway, he was fired. There was a big hoopla about it. And so I got the bright idea. We looked up what we thought was his address in Minneapolis. Actually, I think three Tim Olmsteds came up, and I forget why we chose the one we did. Anyway, I sent this Tim Olmsted a white book and an introductory packet, unsolicited, of Northwest Front literature, and I wasn't sure whether we'd gotten the right address. Apparently not. Anyway, we got a letter. Sally, you want
to... Oh, I think we got the right address.
To whom it may concern, please stop sending me your racial mailings. They're disturbing. I would also like to request how you received my home address. So he doesn't want any mail from us, but he wants to know how we received his home address. I don't know how else we're going to tell him. I guess I could just say our space station. We looked you up, Tim.
Well, no, we're telling him right now. See, he doesn't want any more racial mail from us, but he wants us to tell him how we got his address. And so
Google is your friend.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's that simple. And by the way, I think this is a perfectly legitimate way of possibly rounding up support. Some of you guys out there, if you see something like that in the media, if you have, for example, some person who is a victim of black crime, if you have some person who is a victim of political correctness in some way, some teacher that gets fired for calling his ugly monkey students a bunch of ugly monkeys and that sort of stuff, whatever. Go ahead and send that person's address to us here at the NF. A little bit of explanation. This person is a teacher who got fired. This person is a victim of nigger crime. Got the crap beaten out of him by a flash mob, something like that. And then we will send him a white book, which is designed to be a self-contained explanation as to what the NF is and what we plan to do. Send him some leaflets, maybe some cards. I mentioned last week we got all kinds of business cards now. See if we can get them to the northwestfront.org website. This Tim Olmsted that we sent the stuff to, I don't know if that was the right Tim Olmsted or not, possibly not, but I hope that he at least took the time to go to the website and check it out.
I would say, judging by the reaction, it's probably the right guy.
Yeah.
I see tear streaks on this letter.
Well, he probably reacted in the same way that most whites do when this happened. The poor guy, just like those poor girls apologizing for their so-called racist YouTube rant, this guy probably went crawling back to the school system on his belly, weeping and wailing, gnashing his teeth, rending his garments, banging his forehead on the floor, begging and pleading to be given his job back and his pension and his 401k and everything that Americans live for. That's the trouble with white Americans. Some of them aren't necessarily personally cowardly. I mean, if they saw a burning building with kids inside, they'd probably run inside and try to pull the kids out. They'd probably try and pull somebody out of a car wreck. They'd probably try and help some little old lady that was being mugged. But you threaten a white man's job, you threaten his material wealth, you threaten his pension, you threaten his standing in the community as a good liberal and a good herd animal, you threaten anything material in his life, and a white man will fold like a lawn chair. Some of us still have physical courage. We don't have moral courage, and that, frankly, is the kind we need right now.
So I guess if we hear about things like this happening in the news, people getting fired, and their names just happen to be Bob Johnson or Steve Anderson, then what are we supposed to do if we're going to have a lot of people in that city angry with us? But
unless somebody has any...
What else are we going to chew the fat over?
Well, let's go over Drudge here.
Let's see what's on Drudge Report.
Okay, well, Andrew Breitbart died.
Yeah.
I just one quick comment. Without getting into any details, I always got the impression that Andrew Breitbart was one of these neoconservatives who knew more than he was telling, so to speak. Some of the things he did against the Obama regime, especially that little trick with sending in the guy and the woman posing as a pimp and the whore and asking Acorn to help set them up and help them evade taxes and that sort of stuff. Put it this way, I think Andrew Breitbart knew.
One thing I have to wonder about Breitbart is, how do you die at 43 of natural causes?
Drugs. Natural causes is always code for drugs.
You know, even if it was a heart attack, that's not all that natural at 43.
A nice, ugly picture of Hillary, but other than...
Actually, she's looking not quite as hideous there. That's probably one of her better shots.
Other than that, Drudge today is mostly about that. These stupid Republican primaries. I mean, look, we're going to be stuck with Mitt Romney. I've explained this before. Romney is a palooka. He is there to take a dive in 2012 and get Obama reelected, because that's the arrangement the two parties think they have. Each party gets 8 years in the White House, and the party that's supposed to lose throws the second term election, I should say, and blah, blah, blah. Okay, now it's time to get McFunky again with Rollins Cross. Last week, one of the comments I made was to the effect that at some point in time, we as a movement or a community or a subculture, whatever you want to call us, need to sit down and perform what they refer to in AA as a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves with relation to the years from 1987 to 2002. With a view towards determining exactly who did what and why, and coming to terms with some conclusions about certain people and events from that period, which, while they're pretty clear to me, and were pretty much clear to me at the time, a lot of people among us do not want to face up to or come to grips with. Now, this is understandable. Nobody likes to admit that they've been duped or that they've made mistakes, sometimes terrible mistakes. I said last week that this time is not yet and won't come about for quite a while, because we're just not ready to deal with it.
You can't handle the truth!
However, I think it might be a good idea to begin the process by introducing those of you who weren't around at the time, which is most of us in one way or another. Either we were too young or we weren't aware or involved racially. Anyway, maybe you need to start learning some of the players and hearing some of the good things that happened back then in the nutty 90s. It wasn't all lunacy and goat dancing. Now, this is an excerpt from the original Race and Reason, as opposed to Tom Metzger's later version, hosted by Dr. Herbert Poinsett from Atlanta. I think Dr. Poinsett's dead now, but if he's not, I hope someone will let me know and give him my best. Anyway, in this segment, Dr. Poinsett is interviewing another old comrade of mine, the famous revisionist Ernst Zundel, whom I worked with personally for about 18 months during the great Reedy, West Virginia experiment. Which is a Grandpa Simpson story for another time. Notice that I said revisionist, not white nationalist or racist. You see, that's something a lot of people never got about Ernst. As you will hear in this interview, Ernst is, in fact, not a racialist or an anti-Semite, which I always found rather surprising in view of the way the Jews treated him. He is definitely an anti-Zionist and a genuine scholar devoted to truth at all costs, and we all know how he paid for it. One last thing. This show was taped in 1987, and the sound quality isn't as good as it might be. I hope you can all understand it.
Welcome to another Race and Reason, a ray of light in a sea of darkness. This is Race and Reason from Toronto, Canada, and today my guest is Ernst Zundel, the gentleman who is the leader in the fight against the Holocaust legend. Mr. Zundel, give us a little background, where you were born.
Yes.
And why you decided to come?
Yeah, let me start off by thanking you for coming all the way from the United States to Toronto to see me, because when you invited me onto your program, I had to turn it down, since recently I had been banned from visiting the United States after having been to your country many, many times, traveled all over the United States for the last 30 years, loving American society, loving the American people, and certainly being very interested in American history. Because America is, as far as I'm concerned, the closest country in the world to Germany, where I hail from. So I want to thank you for having me on the program and coming up here.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
How did I get involved in the Holocaust?
Right.
I think as a German, that's a very natural question, because it is really portrayed in the media that the Germans are the villains, the Jews are the victims. So really, as a German, you get confronted with the Holocaust in all its implications every single day. I actually left Germany because I felt guilty, even though I was only a child of 6 when the war was over. I was in diapers when these alleged crimes took place. Yet I believe the Allies, of course, reinforced the belief that we shared collective guilt as Germans for generations for this thing. And so I was a victim of post-war Allied education, believed in the Holocaust lock, stock and barrel. I believed the Holocaust like Americans believed that George Washington was an American president. And a great one at that, you see. Right. So to me, I imbibed that virtually with my mother's milk, that we were guilty. As to the Allied propaganda always was, during the war and after the war, that the Germans were these mass murderers, exterminationists, that these people were not guilty of anything. And so I was a young man with a troubled conscience. And when the American occupying powers in West Germany forced the German government by all kinds of means, after the Korean invasion by the North Koreans, to kind of rearm. My year, born 1939, was the first year to be drafted into a new German army. And of course, here I had been getting all this propaganda, how terrible the German armies were, how murderous the officer corps was, how murderous the generals were. And suddenly I was going to be drafted into a new German army with the same generals and the same officers, because that's all they had. I said, the first opportunity I'm going to get, I'm going to leave this country and I'm going to find a place in the world where a young man does not get drafted against his conscience to kill another man in a military force. The only place in the world was Canada, and so I ended up here as a young man of 19. Still believing the Holocaust, lock, stock and barrel, every single thing, gas chambers, deportations, cremations, the same confusion that everybody has, mixing up gas ovens with crematories. I was your prototype believer in the Holocaust. And thank God I came to this country where they have the libraries and the information still less censored than they were in Europe. And it is this country that set me free.
All right, now, when did you begin to doubt the Holocaust? How old were you at the time?
19.
All right, you started doubting. And yeah. When did you start to go into deep investigation of the so-called Holocaust?
19 and a half. As soon as I came over here to Canada, I, of course, suffered culture shock because I had lived in this homogeneous society, which is Germany. One language, one people, right. One culture. I had met really nothing but Germans except for some of the occupying army personnel, French soldiers, Moroccan troops, the odd American who would drive through our town and so on. So I was almost cut off from intercourse with the world, not as cosmopolitan as most Americans are that have see different races, different people. I saw my first colored man when I came to Toronto at age 19.
Yeah.
And so when I came here and was able to absorb intellectual input through a totally different language, namely English, suddenly my horizon became so broadened that I began to say, my goodness, is it possible that there's two opposite, diametrically opposite outlook on events in the war, for instance, which was a very recent memory to me as a child, the bombing raids, the what you call the liberation, we call it the occupation of Germany.
Right.
And so I had the total German viewpoint from the ordinary working class, the education in the school, which was Allied brainwashing. And here I saw Anglo-Saxon Canadian people reading in their daily newspapers a totally distorted picture of German people and German history, you see? I mean, the cultural history of Germany. Everything that we saw, Hogan's Heroes was a big show at that particular time. Rat Patrol was another one. And it was grotesque, the caricature, the negative stereotyping of the German. And so my conversion of being guilt-ridden to wondering why the Anglo-Saxon world would portray my father's generation and my own people in such a terrible way was very quick. And so by 19 and a half, Ernst was on the trail of the truth. And I was very fortunate in meeting a former Royal Canadian Mounted Police undercover agent who spoke some German. And he said to me, oh, I know a man in Quebec. He has got this wonderful German library. He speaks German. He knows about all these topics. Why don't you go and see him? And it was a fateful moment in my life because I immediately, thirsting for information and truth, decided I was going to see this French-Canadian man whom he had mentioned. A week later, ended up driving to Montreal, Quebec, encountered this man who immediately made me welcome in his home and met one of the greatest men of my life. He was a former French-Canadian officer, greeted me in German when he knew I was German, made me welcome in his home, and within 3 hours, that man gave me a crash course in uncensored European history from a third dimension. Here I had the German version that I grew up with, the Allied brainwashing, plus the Anglo-Saxon input when I first came here. And here was a French-Canadian who, from the eyes of a Frenchman whose family had lived here for hundreds of years, gave me a certain balance in it. It was really, really good. And this man liberated me. I walked out of this French-Canadian's home, his name was Adrien Arcand, like a born-again Christian would say after he met Christ. And that was, to me, the liberation, the spiritual liberation for Ernst Zündel from the cross of guilt that the Allies had imposed on us came in 1960 when I first met this French-Canadian man.
All right, now let me ask you this. Now you started to investigate. Where, when, why, and how, all in one, what opposition did you meet, and why do you think the Jews have promulgated this myth for over... It started back in 1933, really, even before World War II, when the Jews declared war against Germany and Hitler. Right. Why do you think the Jews have fostered this lie on the white Western world? Because that's what it's on, the white Western world.
Yeah.
Why have they done that?
Boy, that's there's three programs already in this one question. The investigation with me started first through eyewitnesses, of course, that I knew that had gone through the war, you see. When I went back to Europe to visit my folks, I met all these German soldiers that had been in the armed forces that would have had to see something because millions of people can't be transported to different places without having encountered people or officers or people who were part of the administration and so on. So what I was bringing to the struggle was, number one, an understanding of German. It was my native tongue, that I could read all the original documents in German, that I could meet the men who were instrumental in doing this. And I was fortunate in having a trade, the graphic art, in which I made very good money, that I virtually had an unlimited budget. I was able to travel all over the world, did so interviewing people from counts to admirals in England to general. The research, how I did it, first I started by informing myself through books, then I started by needing a secretary to carry on correspondence, and I began to do it in three languages, German, English, and French, and very quickly found out that there were scholars in all three language groups that had already tackled this particular issue, and I was very fortunate to benefit from their research. There was in France a Frenchman called Paul Racinier, who did the seminal work in France, the basic work into the Holocaust. In Germany, there was a German newspaper editor called Arthur Ehrhardt, who did excellent work. Another German writer called Erich Kern. There was a German newspaper that was very good called the National- und Soldatenzeitung, which covered this particular area, bringing forth many original documents. Then there was the French Canadians, as I said, that I met over here. And one Jew had a tremendous influence on me. And he was a Romanian born, but now living in Germany. So I refer to him as a German Jew for convenience sake. All my correspondence with him, my interviews, and the books that he wrote, he writes in the German language. He does not believe that 6 million Jews died in gas chambers or by being thrown into live crematory ovens himself. And he was a man who lived during that time, and he reinforced in me the belief that if a Jew has the courage to come out to say all this propaganda is untrue, that I as a German could do no less after proper investigation. So you could say that he reinforced in me my findings, because he was an absolutely objective man. I must tell you that the Zionists reserve for the people that don't toe the party line more vicious punishment for their own people than they even mete out to people like myself. And since I have been bombed, beaten, spat at, kicked, dragged through the courts, banned from the mail, that will mean something.
I agree, because I think many, many American Jews are totally ignorant of what went on, and they believe what they're told by their rabbi. They don't question, as the average Christian doesn't question his priest or his minister.
Yeah. You see, the role of the rabbi is a very different one in Jewish society,
right,
than we, our priests. And we Gentiles make this mistake. We're ignorant, you know. We are too lazy intellectually to investigate what the role of a rabbi is in the Jewish community. And he is far more concerned with temporal things than our priests
correct
are.
He's a teacher. He teaches.
Yeah, right. And I have never met, and this may sound like a contradiction, Jews, generally speaking, prize education. There is many, many people in universities, law, university professors, writing and so on, that are educated, university educated Jews. And yet, strange as it may sound, as a contradiction it might sound, they are the most brainwashed people on the face of the earth.
So true.
They are so emotionalized that I'll tell you, I feel pity for the Jews more than I feel for the Germans with all these hate programs. Because the German knows it didn't happen. A Jew doesn't know whether it happened or not, living in North America. And so he sees all these horrors, this sadomasochistic, perverse, sick stuff that the Holocaust film usually presents with whipping, beating, punching. There was even this one grotesque film where the Germans were drilling into the teeth of some person to get a confession.
Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, you know?
So Laurence Olivier, I remember that.
Now, what kind of sick minds are let loose in these Holocaust productions? It is like a perversion on the public airway. So I feel sorry for the Jews that they are subjected to it more than the Germans, because the German at least can refer back to his grandfather or his father and say, hey, did you guys really do this, or what happened, and so on. What will a Jew do?
Yeah. Also, you and I were talking before about there was much, or at least a fair amount of collaboration between the National Socialist Germans and the Zionist Jews in Germany.
Yeah, this is a very little understood and really well camouflaged secret that the Zionists today, of course, are embarrassed about, but there is a Jewish writer called Edwin Black from Chicago.
Yes, I've
heard of him. He opened up this can of worms with a book called The Transfer Agreement, in which he spills the beans on this policy that the Zionist leadership had in collaborating with National Socialist Germany. And the interesting thing that I ought to point out is that the National Socialist government had a policy of wanting the Jews out of German society. True. And the Zionist policy was to want the Jews in Israel. And so here was a kind of a coinciding, a meshing of the two policies. And many times politics make strange bedfellows. We know that. True. In American history. We see Jesse Jackson with his rainbow coalition, right? True. And so on. And so here was this German Zionist policy meshing perfectly. And what we had, in effect, was the Nazis wanting the Jews out and the Jews wanting the Jews out. You know, and so we had, according to J.G. Burke, 150,000 Jews left Germany within the first year after National Socialism took power. And his own friend, he told me, left from Germany to Palestine with two railroad cars full of antique furniture, furnishings, pianos, and so on, that he was able to take out of Germany to Palestine.
Right.
And many of these people took their money, and the National Socialist Government of Germany had some arrangement under what has become the transfer agreement to transfer their funds in a very ingenious way to Palestine by some exchange of trade. It was a very cleverly done process, and in effect, the German Zionist collaboration saved National Socialism. Without this collaboration between those two isms, Germany might have been defeated, Hitler might have been kicked out of his government in 1934 already. So this is true. I mean, as strange as it may sound, and the Zionists will deny it up and down, all you have to do is go to your bookstore, get yourself a book called The Transfer Agreement, author Edwin Black, and that's where it is, black and white.
And one final cut from this week's featured musical group, Rollins Cross. This is an old Irish tune called The Little Beggar Man.
Thank you.
Well, here I am again, running the show way, way long. I really need to start clipping some of these sound segments a lot shorter. Anyway, my closing monologue will be pretty brief this week. I just want to mention something which I'm sure a lot of you have noticed over the past few months, and that is I want to apologize for the length of time it is taking me to respond to many of your emails. Now, the fact is that although we did undergo kind of a winter doldrums period in January and February, we've rebounded with a giant boing, and once more I'm receiving on the average of over 200 emails a day, and I mean actual emails that require a response, not spams, not cyber gibberish of various kinds. I'm talking about actual emails asking questions or sending me stuff, usually unsolicited, which I probably should take a look at and usually would like to. Now, as some of you know, I have for the past 6 months or so had two part-time assistants who, among other things, helped with the email flow. But I'm afraid I've lost both of them for the moment. No, they haven't run away. It's just that the inevitable has happened, and they both got real jobs. One of these guys has now moved into a position with his employer where it's probably best that he step back for a bit because this is an opportunity that he really doesn't want to screw up, and I absolutely concur. I always feel really bad when somebody's movement involvement gets them jammed up and defunctionalized. He's still around and still helping, just not in quite so public a capacity. The second individual helped me after he lost his job in Seattle, not because of anything he did or anything racial, just typical American bullshit. It took him about 6 weeks to find another job in his field, but that unfortunately means that I now no longer have him around 3 days a week like I did. Bear that in mind. This comrade who was laid off got another job in 6 weeks. Actually, a better paying job. Of course, he actually has a trade, like I have advised all of you young white boys listening to this to acquire. But the fact is that once you're here on the ground in an area like Seattle, you will always be able to get something, presuming you show even the smallest bit of hustle and you don't do things like going on job interviews unbathed for 2 weeks or crap like that. Anyway, I just wanted to let you folks know that until I can sweet-talk one of the other comrades into coming around and giving me a hand, I'm going to be doing a lot of the basic stuff myself, folding and stapling Northwest Observer, stuffing envelopes, and of course handling all those emails. Please bear with me and remember this is a good sign. I'd be worried if I didn't have more work than I could handle. Now, I've completed Section 3 of Freedom's Sons, which is one thing these assistants were able to free me up for, and one of the reasons I need helpers, to give me time to write. And I'll probably start on Section 4 in about a month's time. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.